Currently, it's by statute, it follows the dividend. The legislature has always inflation-proof to maintain the purchasing power of the permanent fund, but we think it should go before and be placed before the other statutes and be placed in the dividend. It also inflation-proofs the entire fund and not just the principal of the fund. This is achieved by a spending limit. As I noted, we would suggest that the limit be no more than 5% of the five-year moving average of the fund. One could, of course, appropriate less, but we believe that a limit of 5% is appropriate. Currently, the entire earnings reserve can be appropriated. And so the magnitude varies from year to year. Near the end of the bull market, that would have meant that 25% of the permanent fund could have been appropriated if deemed appropriate. There have been a couple times this year where the actual earnings reserve has gone negative, and that meant that no money would necessarily be available to be appropriated. So you can see big swings based on what market conditions are. Using a moving average of the fund versus the current methodology really improves stability from year to year versus the status quo. Again, 25% zero versus 5% over time. We think that's an important issue. The other important thing is, how did we come up with 5%? Well, we believe, after looking at 77 years of historical data and also looking prospectively at our capital markets, we believe that our current diversified portfolio will be able to achieve 5% over time. That's 5% real income in excess of an income in excess of inflation. The old statute was developed about 26 years ago, and people only thought about bonds during that period. And people would buy fixed income securities, bonds. It's a low volatility. It's income driven. And so the statutes made sense 26 years ago, but we believe, now, because we invest more in the equity market, more volatile, high expected return, about half the fund is invested in equity markets, you're going to get more volatility, but you're going to get less income as well, unless the managers take profits over time. So it is within the limits of our goals on asset allocation and statutes. We also think this is far more predictable than the current methodology. The constitutional amendment is now written, and Bob Bartholomew is prepared to discuss that. It has what we call a look-back provision. That means that the computation would be the based on the five previous fiscal years. That means that when decision makers, when legislatures come to Juneau in January, you'll know exactly the amount of money that would be available to use as elected officials deemed appropriate. If you ask me right now, we do have a positive earnings reserve. It's about $2 billion. We have a positive return for the fiscal year, but we've incurred so much volatility. If you ask me what the number will be like in June 30, I can't tell you with any degree of predictability. And so what we're proposing will substantially increase the predictability that we believe is would be helpful. That very briefly are my comments, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to ask questions or ask Mr. Bartholomew to go through the actual language.
If you could go through the language, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the version that is before House Finance is the CS for House Joint Resolution number 26, Judiciary. And basically, it's a two-page amendment making a couple of changes to the Constitution, and I'll just start with the title being kind of a policy statement of what is the reason that we're trying to, or that the trustees are proposing the change. And it states in the title that they do want to protect the permanent fund from inflation and do that by limiting the amount that can be appropriated annually. So that's just the statement of what we're trying to do. On page 1, line 10, is the first change to the actual language that's in the existing Constitution, and that is referring to a new second paragraph that will be added to the Constitution. Currently, there is one paragraph in the Constitution that talks about the Alaska Permanent Fund, and now we will be adding a second. So line 10 refers to that, and we'll talk about that on page 2. Then on line 11 is probably the most significant change proposed to the Constitution, and that is we're taking out the word principle, which is currently how people have looked at the protection of the permanent fund. And the change that's being made in the Constitution today, or being proposed by the trustees, is that we will protect the permanent fund through a spending limit. Through 5% a year is the up to that amount is the most that can be taken. And how the difference is basically it's a policy call that balances you. By removing the word principal, you will always be able to have a distribution annually from the permanent fund, limited to 5%. It cannot go to zero, which it can today. When the earnings reserve goes to zero, there's no distribution. So you're balancing the benefit of being able to have a distribution every year against the risk that in the short term you might spend down the fund. And that is a significant policy decision. Then moving down to lines 13 and 14, what's being deleted from the Constitution is a current statement that says all income from the permanent fund would be deposited into the general fund unless otherwise provided by law. And that language would be removed because the intent would be all income earned by the permanent fund would remain in the permanent fund. And after you remove the word principal, instead of having principal and earnings reserve, which we currently have basically two pools of funds, those would be combined, and you would have one pool of money, the permanent fund, and so you would not need to separately account for the where you place the income. It would stay in the permanent fund. Turning to page 2, starting on line 2, that is the new paragraph that basically establishes a not-to-exceed spending limit of 5% of the year-end market value, and we do average that over a 5-year period. And line 4, when it reads, basically actually starting with the last two words on line 3, for the first 5 of the 6 fiscal years immediately preceding the fiscal year. And the best way to explain that is to give you an example. Under the current rules, as the legislature is working today on the FY04 budget, you don't know what's available because the 5-year average that we'll use includes the June 30th that hasn't finished yet. We're still 6 weeks there. By looking back 1 year, looking back 6 years to get a 5-year average, that means it's the last June 30th. June 30th, 2002 would have been the end point for calculating what's available for 04. So as you are going through deliberations on your budget, you'll know exactly how much is available. Then it would be a legislative decision of how much you wanted to spend. But you would at least know specifically what's available. And we see a lot of benefit. And it not only helps the legislature, it really helps the permanent fund managers, the investments, to know approximately how much is the legislature going to be appropriating, and then they can time the investments as far as when are we going to have to sell investments to be able to fund an appropriation. And as the executive director just explained, we're 6 weeks from June 30th. We don't even know if there'll be money available, so it's really hard to do cash flow planning on whether we just will stay fully invested. Then the last part of the change, Section 3, is actually language that was proposed by Legislative Legal, and it's a transitional language that just makes it clear that any money that's in the earnings reserve at the date that the citizens of Alaska adopt this constitutional amendment, it remains part of the permanent fund. There's been some discussion of whether the earnings are really the general fund's money and not the permanent fund. This transitional language would make it clear. It stays with the permanent fund. Section 4 states that to make this effective, to change the Constitution, it would go before the voters of Alaska at the next general election, which is scheduled to be November 2004. So this would be something where we would have to provide education, and the people of Alaska would weigh in on this proposed change.
Thank you. For the interest of time, if there are any questions, we will bring it up at a later date. In case we do not have that chance to ask any questions, I will appoint the subcommittee at this time. And it will be Kevin Meyer as the chair of the subcommittee, Eric Croft, Representative Croft, and Representative Jewell, Representative Chenault, and Representative Whitaker. I tried to get people throughout the state, around the state, to be on that. So my plan, hopefully, is to have this brought up around the state and get the people's input. With that, I'd like to thank you, and hope if we do plan to bring it up again for questions, if the committee would like for them to come forward again, please ask me. If not, we will see you on the road.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll look forward to working with the subcommittee.
Next, we'll go to Senator Green. Please come forward, and I'll let her call the shots here. you have two bills up here. We are supposed to go back on the floor at 4. I haven't heard any bells.
I haven't heard you guys either.
So it's your call, whichever one you'd like to bring up first.
I'll bring up Senate Bill 41.
Senate Bill 41.
I think many of you have had the opportunity. For the record, my name is Lida Green. I represent the core area of the Mat-Su Valley, and I'm accompanied by my grain trust, Tracy Carpenter and Jacqueline Tupou. And many of you had the opportunity this year to hear the report of the Medicaid audit that came forward. And a couple of the recommendations included in that audit are provided for in this legislation. Recommendation 7 states DMA's director should provide for a full-time ongoing service provider audit function. And recommendation 12, the legislature should consider adopting specific criminal statutes related to Medicaid fraud to enhance the Medicaid fraud control unit's effectiveness. One of the issues we have found in this state in reviewing Medicaid costs for the last few years, that the cost of the Medicaid program in Alaska has increased.
Can you stand by one, please?
Surely.
I think we need to get the bills out. Yeah. I'm sorry. Madam.
I trust you, Senator SB Green, 45. But I'd like to at least have the bill in front of me. I'm sure it's a good
Just
bill.
Take my word.
Well, I was going to. And then
I had one because I want to be prepared for Senator Green.
41. Thank you. Again, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry.
As a powerful Senate finance.
The powerful Senate Finance Committee. You forget.
Powerful chairman.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Speaking to the powerful co-chair of the powerful House Finance Committee.
It's about as
and your
about as powerful as
your co-workers.
As they tell
and
us.
And your powerful members.
You've got too much power.
I know.
BS or something. Right?
Thank you.
To the people.
Has everybody got their bills?
They went down.
Okay. Has everybody received their bill?
I don't want any bill.
Just follow our lead.
You got it. Just doing this one.
Just love it.
No. Until next week. Okay.
I'll be right back.
I put you down as a
whenever they're ready.
Ready?
Thank you.
Okay, we're back on record. Senator Green, continue to the test point, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, the cost of the Medicaid program in Alaska has increased an average of 20% per year since 1999, growing the program from $396 million in FY99 to $936 million in FY04, a total increase of $540 million over 5 years. We have limited ability to contain the majority of the cost factors driving these increases, such as the increasing number of eligible recipients, the increased use of health services, and the rising cost of prescription drugs and long-term care. However, as pointed out in the Medicaid audit, There's evidence that waste, fraud, and abuse of public funds used to deliver Medicaid services exist both in Alaska and throughout the nation, both in, by account of the Medicaid audit and from other information we receive. There's the estimate of 7% for waste, and then in addition, there is an abuse factor that's also attributed to the program nationwide, 10 to 20%. And if we go to the conservative side and we add these together or compound them in any way, it gets to be a rather frightening figure of our soon-to-be $1 billion Medicaid program in the state of Alaska. We have no specific laws related to fraud health care crimes in the state of Alaska. It makes it very difficult to prosecute against dishonest Medicaid providers or recipients and keep them from continuing to abuse the system. A couple of years ago, we had committee meetings in the Senate Hess Committee and the Joint House Hess Committee, and we heard a report that further piqued our interest in this particular subject, and at the time were greeted with information that brought forth the difficulty in prosecuting in the state of Alaska. And apparently, to this time, the prosecutor must use coincidental criminal statutes and other civil statutes to prosecute someone for Medicaid fraud. We are spending far too much money to not be able to go after an abuser with our own criminal statutes. The nice thing about what this bill does, though, it encourages and enables the and directs the department to have ongoing audits through the contract with an independent audit firm. And these firms do exist in the United States. And one of the good things we're going to do with this particular audit firm, as opposed to those we've used in the past, we're not only going to allow them to do the audit, but we're requiring that they go ahead and start the investigation. That's been part of the lag time in the past and part of the complaint of medical folks, that the audits just took too long. So we made the provision that the audit firm would begin the investigation, and then as that information is gathered and cleaned up, would be turned over to our investigative folks and or to the department for further work. Some of it's very simple to deal with. Some of it's requesting additional information, verification of charges, billings, and we want to provide the statutes and the direction to all our Medicaid providers, to all our recipients, and primarily that we set aside an enormous amount of general fund money to match the incredible amount of federal money, and we want that money to go to the purpose it's intended, and that's the health care of people who need the Medicare program. With that, I'll close for questions, and I know you have an incredible witness on the line, Steve Branchflower, who assisted in the formation of this legislation and can probably give a far better wrap-up or in addition to what I've given and give you some very good information and answer questions.
Thank you, Senator Green. Looks like we have Don Kitchen instead of Steve.
He's more fun for us to play with.
Okay.
He's more fun for us to play with.
He's just as an outstanding a testifier.
I don't know about that.
Right. Oh, and I understand, and I appreciate that. I will just tell you that Steve Branchflower helped in the creation. Okay. And I will also like to add, Mr. Chairman, that this has come through an incredible, incredible long meetings with Hess, Law, and the various parties involved to bring us to the point we are today. And I've reached agreement.
All right, do we have any questions for Senator Green? Representative Foster.
Yeah, I wanted to thank you for this legislation. It makes a lot of sense. I was wondering here on the one fiscal note, it says a base facility audit is $26,000 a year and then a non-facility audit $13,000, and that'd be $73,000. Do these facilities pay for the audit? Like, how are the audits paid? Who pays for the audits?
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question. The audit function will be paid for out of the amount recovered from the lawsuits that will ensue. And in the past several years, certainly Steve Branchflower could speak to this, and I'm sure Don Kitchen as well, the past history, and I think that generally the the ratio of money invested to the money returned is 8-1 or something. And so you may have heard of the Fairbanks case, the dentist who was the drugs and the, on the street and resale and coming back. And then there was a doc in Anchorage who was prosecuted, I think, last year under the same provision. And so the proceeds from those lawsuits, we would be allowed to direct some of those to pay for the audits in the Department of Health and Social Service that that they would contract with.
Okay. Don't see any of the questions. Maybe we'll go on to Don Kitchen, and then you can stand by.
Thank you.
And see if Don generates some more questions. Mr. Kitchen, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, please proceed.
I had no statement to make out of here. Simply answer questions.
You're doing good.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're just available for questions?
That's all I was here for. I didn't have a statement prepared.
Well, we do have some questions for you. Representative Stoltz?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess when you think of the types of frauds that occur with government programs, welfare fraud, you usually think it's the applicants or the people that are getting it. Are we talking mostly about providers? Is that why there's probably more ability to... Is that who the real target probably is in this, or...?
The statutes were written to encompass being able to prosecute both recipients and providers. I specifically do providers unless there is a connection with recipients. But I think probably the focus was on providers.
That's your question. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, sure. If I could add one word. I know during the earlier version of the bill, there happened to be a recipient Medicaid meeting, a work group here in Juneau, and they read through the bill to review it, and they said they really liked it. However, they thought recipients should be included, and somehow the recipients had been excluded to that time. At their request, we added it, and they said they definitely should be held to that same high standard.
So we have stakeholder meetings for welfare and Medicaid programs now.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Berkowitz?
Yeah, I've got a question. Don, how do you currently prosecute these kind of cases? What sort of statutes do you use?
Representative Berkowitz, through the chair, generally we'd have to use theft statutes or a scheme to defraud, which at present has a mental element requirement of specific intent. And as you probably recall, trying to prove specific intent with sometimes hundreds of characters involved becomes virtually impossible without having a witness on the ground inside when the scheme was hatched. We have no way of disproving the essential defense of willful ignorance, which is where the provider simply shrugs his shoulders and says, gee, I didn't know that. In this highly regulated industry, this statute, Senate Bill 41, requires the provider to comply with the regulations that they agree to up front and make them responsible for that relatively scarce resource that they actually hold the keys to.
Next question is on Section 4705, 230, page 5, determination of value, aggregation of amounts. As I read the bill, you in essence would aggregate the number of instances when someone committed a fraud and lead to one charge?
The aggregation of amounts was taken, I believe, from the theft statutes by Mr. Branchflower. And yes, it does permit aggregating the amounts into a particular charge.
Third question is the amounts that, I'm sorry for skipping around a little bit. I don't have as much time to do my homework as I used to. Page 4 and 5, the amounts for a C felony is $500 to $25,000, and the A misdos are less than $500. In the theft statute, is that still the breaking point between misdemeanors and felonies?
Yes, they're all the same numbers from the theft statute.
As I recall, and maybe you know, there's some discussion about raising those levels because $500 is at least in the theft statutes, the Criminal Justice Action, or CJAC, it was on the committee. I can't remember what the acronyms were, but suggested raising those amounts because we were sweeping up all kinds of conduct into felony land that should have been misdemeanors. Do you recall what those numbers were?
Actually, I don't.
Thanks.
Representative Hawkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don, I know that, I seem to recall that, you know, this drafter, this bill before us, has been through a lot of iterations during the course of this. And Lida is nodding severely as I say that. I believe I was aware that earlier on in the drafting process, your department had some concerns with the structure of the bill and some things they wanted to go forward. I'm wondering, is the bill before us largely something that your department is, and particularly yourself, are you comfortable with it?
Yes, I am. Very comfortable with it.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Don or Senator Green? I think Representative Berkowitz is working on one. It's scary.
Let's move the bill quickly.
Yeah, I'll say that. Anything else, Representative Berkowitz?
No, I think I'm going to have a proposed amendment. It's sort of...
Is it in your mind, proposing it?
Well, I would raise the amount to $1,000 for a felony as opposed to $500. $500 is... people get to that fairly quickly. If we're aggregating claims and you're really going after...
An anti-business bet, huh?
They're going to get to $1,000 in claims fairly quickly. I think this will also help the fiscal note in that the smaller cases, if they are prosecuted, can be prosecuted as misdemeanors, which are less expensive to prosecute.
Is that your amendment, conceptual?
Yeah. I'd be changing on page 4, line 29, change 500 to 1,000, and on page 5, line 2, change 500 to 1,000.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
And I'm trying to recall the testimony in front of the Criminal Justice Assessment Commission, what the amount was. I think that was the amount they decided they wanted to increase the theft levels to. Those theft levels were set many, many years ago, and with inflation, it's inappropriate to $500. I recall instance of someone stole a jacket, and it was a $500 jacket, and it's a felony, and... it wound up being a very expensive prosecution, and I think that if you have a little bit higher breaking point, it saves the state money in the long run.
And Representative Berkowitz, I think sitting on Judiciary with you last year, I think we did raise that from 500 to 1,000 on certain, certain instances. I don't remember which ones it was. Senator Green, what do you think of the amendment?
I can remember this discussion when we were working on these numbers, and there are certain offenses that a person can be involved with. It's very low-dollar offenses that don't have a lot of dollar value, but they do a lot of harm to the system. And that was the reason for the low entry on this, the low floor. And because not everything is going to be quantified by value, such as a major theft would be, or the... and that's the only thing, and I don't remember if it was low-priced drugs that you might be doing something with, and as far as the street value, there'd be very little street value. But the fact that it was a bad deed was the thing that caused it to be a violation of the Medicaid, the purpose of the Medicaid program, and that's what they're trying to stop.
Well, if I could ask Don Kitchen a question.
Sure.
Does that break point make any difference to most of the cases you work on?
I would have to say most of the cases that we would do involve more than $500 or $1,000. Quite honestly, they don't generally come to our attention until they're at least that amount. On the other hand, in other states, their felony breaking point is $100.
Okay. I'll, hearing that, I'll withdraw the amendment.
Okay. Amendment's withdrawn.
I'm worried about criminal rights being eroded by
any other amendments or questions? Discussion? Seeing none.
Anybody else to testify?
I don't think there's anyone else to testify, is there?
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move that we move from committee CS response to substitute Senate Bill 41, finance, individual recommendations, and the attached fiscal notes.
Any objection? Seeing none, committee's, or bills moved from committee. Thank you, Senator Green.
Do you also have 45? Was 45 listed next? Because he had said
45?
Which order I wanted.
Okay, I don't think we have that file either. Okay.
Stay as long as you want.
Take a short recess.
Yeah, we're taking that easy.
This bill was amended to help the Department of Labor and Workforce Development consolidate the workforce investment boards. There were 58 members and 3 boards spread around the state. We'll now have 1 board with 26 members to promote efficiency. That brings us a negative fiscal note, which members of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development
can talk about where that money's going if you'd so like. And with that, I'll close my portion of the presentation and turn it over to my boss.
Senator?
Chairman, can I just tell you what a marvelous improvement you have in this room since you've added Representative Curtula in place of Crawford?
Should we move the bill now, or what's the deal here?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Doug explained it very clearly that we have these teachers at Aptech who have been in TERS for a number of years. They were hired in TERS, and of course they want to stay in TERS, and it's a disadvantage if they're not allowed, if Aptech cannot hire teachers, new teachers into those TERS positions, into that retirement system. And then also the issue of consolidating the workforce boards from three into one and saving money there. So substantial savings, as you can see in the attached fiscal note, $240,000 and then $400,000 after that every year, mainly because that board will have fewer members and there'll be fewer boards. Those are the two issues, Mr. Chairman, that this deals with, those teachers and the boards.
All right, any questions for the sponsor? Are there any amendments? Representative, do you have a question?
No, you ready to vote?
Do you care about anyone in the Senate that wishes to testify at this time on the bill? Anybody on teleconference? We'll close public testimony. What's the wishes of the committee?
Yeah. I think this is a minority leader's a priority, isn't it?
Yes.
I'd like to move this CS for Senate Bill 182 out of committee with individual recommendations, attached fiscal note, and Senator Stevens' blessing.
Any objections? If not, Senate Bill 192.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. If I'd known it was that easy, I'd started out earlier. We're back to House Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 45. Has the minority leader around, or?
No, but I get to stand in.
Okay. Madam Chairman of the powerful Chairman of the powerful Senate Finance Committee.
And to the powerful members of the powerful House Finance Committee, my name is Lyda Green. I represent the core area of the Mat-Su Borough. And somewhat akin to the previous legislation, we have an act relating to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. And I have to tell you that this is a metamorphosis before you. We have gone from a several-page document to a very brief document that we think covers the purpose and the need that we were faced with the information that came to us. And it's, in fact, you had it scheduled here at least 2 weeks ago. And we heard from the Department of Law. And in the meantime, we have spent, again, countless hours working with all the parties involved to the comfort of everyone that's involved, to those of us who would have liked perhaps greater penalties, to those who would have liked no penalty. And we've come to a compromise that we hope that you will join us in supporting. And just a little history, the Division of Ledge Audit was established by territory legislature with the passage of the Fiscal Procedures Act of 1955. It was the time the only audit function that existed was in the office of the auditor in the executive branch. They established the legislative auditor and the division, and there was established the need for impartial auditing. That is clearly spelled out in statute, the role of our Legislative Budget and Audit Committee and the legislative auditor, and provides that the legislature shall appoint an auditor to serve at its pleasure. He shall be a certified, or she shall be a certified public accountant. The auditor shall conduct post audits as prescribed by law and shall report to the legislature and to the governor. As you know, our legislative auditor and Legislative Budget and Audit Committee conducts three kinds of audits. And one of those are those that we bring to, or we bring a request to the Ledge Budget and Audit Committee for, quote, a look-see at an agency. The others are those that go over the various boards and commissions when they're up for sunset review and their post audits. And it's a very significant check so that we can, when we are faced with concerns, complaints, or questions about a system in state government, that we can find out a total picture at one time. And for example, we've had some very powerful audits released this year that have made some fine recommendations, many of which we've accepted and adopted and started to work on. Others we've said, well, we'll wait and see. Perhaps we should take another look at that. But it gives us that information. It's established in law that the auditor has access to those records. The purpose of this legislation is not to establish the power, any additional power in the auditor, other than what it's already given in statute, but to assign a penalty to that person who, on the other side, says, no, we're not going to participate with that audit, and we're not going to give you the information, whether overtly or covertly. And another particular concern of mine was the case of an employee who was ready to participate with the auditor when questioned and was told by a supervisor, you will not participate with the alleged budget and audit interview, and you will not provide information. That person knew that there was information the auditor needed, was not allowed to provide it. If that person is in a certified or licensed status and might lose license or status because of not being truthful in the state system, they're at great risk. So we have included in this language in part of this is the whistleblower section that provides additional protection, and that's in Section 4. And so we have created the hindering with... We've created hindering the legislative budget and audit committee. A person commits hindering the legislative budget and audit committee if the person intentionally fails to give or directs, orders, threatens, restrains, coerces, forces, or prevents another person from giving full cooperation to the legislative auditor or a legislative fiscal analyst. Bear in mind, our legislative auditors and fiscal analysts, when they have been commissioned by our legislative budget and audit committee, are under every veil of confidence, and their records are confidential, and we do not hear all the nitty-gritty. We receive recommendations and final reports, and this includes a violation for the person who hinders, and can be a fine up to $5,000. They may be subject to administrative or reprimand or action, disciplinary action, and that information could become available for public inspection. And because we feel like it's very serious if a person has committed this, and whether a state employee has been dismissed or disciplined for violation of interference or failure to cooperate with the alleged budget and audit committee, and that is, of course, after the violation and court action. And I do think it should be part of their record. And with that, you have an excellent witness on record on the teleconference, I believe, in Steve Branchbauer, who helped in the creation of this legislation.
Okay. Before we get started, did this come from a House Committee substitute or a committee substitute?
Yes. Did
we adopt this?
You did not. You need to.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we had adopted it. Entirely my fault, Mr. Chairman, and I'll take blame for it. So I'd like to move that we adopt House CS for CS for Senate Bill number 45, the W version lockup 51503, as a working document.
Any objection?
And as a worked over document.
No objection. The substitute is before us. Are there any questions? I'm sorry, Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Chairman Williams. Senator Green, I'm not sure if this falls into the purview of this legislation, but something I've observed over the years is when an audit is performed, I've seen external forces, sometimes state officials, trying to prevent or delay the release of it because of consequences. Would this at all cover that? Would that fall within it? And sometimes they're for very nefarious reasons why they're trying to block release or to while the legislature's in action, so we'd see important information that it might be real important in the budget process. And I haven't observed it in this administration because it's pretty early on, but a couple of other administrations. Your comment.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if I could ask Pat Davidson to speak to that, please.
Please come forward, Pat. State your name.
For the record, my name is Pat Davidson with the Division of Legislative Audit. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Stoltz, I would say this addresses it indirectly, and that is, I'd term it obstructionist behavior on the part of an agency. I think that what this will do is it will eliminate it during the course of the audit, which will allow that audit to move forward faster. And then it's totally within the realm of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee itself as to whether reports get released. But this will, I perceive, as being enhancing the efficiency and therefore the timeliness of audit releases.
Any other questions for the sponsor at this time? Representative Petula.
Thank you. First, I really want to thank the sponsor because she made significant changes, and I can see that from the original version and from looking at some of the amendments Representative Croft had already drafted. Just a couple of areas, and one of them was on the last page when we're talking about interference with failure to cooperate with an audit, it mentions on line 9, or other matter within the authority of LBNA. Could you give me an example of what that might be? I'm lucky enough to be on LBNA, but I've only been on this year, and I'm just not certain about what the range might be.
Through the chair, Representative Petula. While audits are done by the Division of Legislative Audit, we at the Division of Legislative Audit or the Legislative Fiscal Analyst may be asked to do, and I can't remember the statutes, prepare reports, memorandums, and other matters as directed by the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. So what they're trying to approach in this is all the official responsibilities that we may be delegated to do under the auspices of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee.
The concern is how minimal does that get? Is there a level where there's things like an audit where it's obvious that it's official and it's saying, you know, we've talked about it or sanctioned it? Is there something that might conceivably slide in there that was really fairly minor, or is it all ordered? Thanks.
Through the chair, I'd like to answer that actually. This is Jacqueline Tipo from Senator Green's staff. When we were doing this, we wanted the whistleblower statute to be as broad as possible because what often happens is she might be unaware of the information even exists. So through one of these other informal processes or, you know, less formal processes that we talked about, there could be information come forward that we didn't even know existed. So the whistleblower statute, we really wanted it to be as broad as possible so that we can really, quote unquote, get all the info.
So this section is relating back to the section on the whistleblower?
It's amending the whistleblower statute. It's adding this to the whistleblower statute and giving employees the protection of the whistleblower statute.
Thank you. Thank you for explaining that. That helps a lot. And then I had one other area, and it was in the section of the information that goes into state employees' files. And now we're going to add in whether a state employee has been dismissed or disciplined for the violation of the interference with the LBNA. But are crimes in this? I didn't see any other crimes that go into state employees' files. Do you know? I'm not up on what goes into state employees' files. And that was the question. Should we put in the LBNA information if we don't put in other crimes? And maybe that's a consideration, but that was the question.
Through the chair, Representative Curtula. Because one of the penalties was a disciplinary action, under the personnel laws, disciplinary actions are confidential. And there was interest that if somebody had violated that statute, that the knowledge of that could not be concealed through the confidentiality of personnel records. And so what this does is it allows that misconduct to be disclosed, publicly disclosed.
Thank you. Thank you. Those were really the two areas I was the most concerned about.
Are there any more questions for the sponsor? Representative Foster.
No, you're from the department? From Ledge?
Audit. Ledgely.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to thank you. Over the years, in various other years, I've seen where departments didn't like a bill.
$8 million on this one and $23 million on this one, but these are both zero. And I just wanted to thank you for your logical analysis that made these zero.
Representative Potter? Excuse me. Are there any more questions? Any amendments? Anyone that wishes to testify at this time?
Mr. Chairman, the Department of Law has come in, and because they were opposed to this at the beginning, I would like it to go on the record that they have contributed and contributed to the support of this and been involved. Just a brief moment.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Scott Nordstrand. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Civil Division, and the Department of Law and the administration is supportive of this committee substitute, and we've worked very hard, I think, with the Senator and her staff to come up with a bill that we think is workable and we can support, and we do.
Thank you. Are there any questions for any Representative Foster?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and move out SB 45 with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Any objections? If not, Senate Bill 45 was some committee with individual recommendations passed fiscal notes.
Thank you.
Hey, can you can a guy sponsor a thing like this?
Sure. Sponsor.
Yeah, I see it's my mm-hmm. Committee.
We did not receive House Bill 277 as of yet, so we won't be hearing that today. We have not received House Bill 196, which is the minority leader's bill. He asked that I waive the bill. It does have a zero fiscal note. And I said, if it does have a zero fiscal note, he can move it if he'd like. But he'd have to go around and ask you, and I'll get him a letter, a memo of support. with that, we have heard everything that we have put out so far, and we do have some bills that have to be heard yet. If we could stand at ease for a few minutes, I'll...
Okay, actually,
Just a question.
I'm pretty easy on you guys.
You're always easy on me.
You should see how it is.
We'll come back to order. For tomorrow, May 17th, 2003, on Saturday, we're going to meet at 10 a.m.
Tomorrow.
Holy
smokes.
The reason we can't start earlier...
That's right, we got a prayer breakfast.
...is we have a prayer breakfast at 8:30, and we go into session approximately noon or 1. We will start... I don't know if in this order, but we will start with Senate Bill 117, eliminating longevity bonus. Senate Bill 119, eliminate APOC. All good bills.
Senate Bill. I thought you were the only good bill around here.
102, charitable gaming revenue. Senate Bill 148, allowable absence, military. Bills previously heard. And possibly under bills previously heard, Senate Bill 213, Connect Arm. And if we get House Bill 277, Pipeline Utilities Regulation, we'll hear that also. And for all intents and purposes, that's all we have before us that are priority bills of the governor or the Senate right now.
Mr. Chairman, yes. I'd like to make a motion.
No motions.
Mm-hmm. A big motion. I move that we don't take up any more House bills unless if they're House Bill 196, Representative Berkowitz's bill, but which we should move out of the committee. But we are at, I think, past the deadline, unless if there's something that has some extraordinary reason. We're past the deadline now when any House bills are going to make any effect this year, so we ought not to hear any more House bills.
Does HB 111 have a finance referral?
No, not yet. We don't know what it's going to do.
You had a finance referral.
What about the...
what we're going to do, I'm going to overrule that motion. We can't vote on it anyway.
Well, you want to take up the spending cap yet, don't you? Sorry.
What we're going to do with the minority leader's bill is that we're going to hopefully waive it if it's all right with members, and there's one amendment that he may have to do on the floor. It would have been amended had it been done correctly, and I believe that one of the other committees had messed up, so we will at least be able to hear his bill, get it waived out of finance tonight, and he can do what he can with it whenever. And we will still be waiting, we're still waiting for House Bill 277 to be heard. That is what's happening tomorrow. Is anything more to come before this committee? If not, this committee is adjourned.
We'll meet tomorrow at 10 p.m., did you say?